If there's one thing I've always loved, it's cooking myself a good meal. And I mean a really good meal. But I gotta say, lately I've been so busy, I think I'm just running out of ideas. I always go to the store and I'm so overwhelmed. I mean, do I want a zucchini or a cucumber? Do I want this? Do I want that? Not to mention, I don't know how fresh these ingredients are, and I'd like to know that I'm eating quality food. HelloFresh gets me right out of that cooking rut. It takes the guesswork out of meal planning, and there's over 40 recipes to choose from every single week. Not to mention, the produce is farm to door for peak ripeness for a bunch of different chef-crafted recipes. So come on, what are you waiting for? Go to HelloFresh.com/50Shadow and use code 50Shadow for 50% off plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/50Shadow. Use code 50Shadow for 50% off plus free shipping to receive America's number one meal kit.
How would you like to be introduced?
Me, Bittu Sehgal, you are asking?
Yes, Bittu Sehgal.
All right. Well, you could introduce me as definitely the editor of Sanctuary Asia, a magazine that was started 40 years ago, and the founder of the Sanctuary Nature Foundation. That would be technically correct.
Okay.
But my real profession is to make sure that my generation doesn't fuck up yours, you know?
Okay. All right. So I'm going to weave that into the introduction. Okay. I'm ready to go. Hi, everyone. I am Renita. I am the creator of Shadow Realm and the Arya Chronicles series. And I'm thrilled to be in conversation today with Bittu Sehgal. He is the editor of Sanctuary Magazine. It's India's, I think, prime environmental magazine that was started 40 years ago or somewhere near there. He is the founder of the Sanctuary Asia Foundation. But I think most of all, he is the one person I can think of, the one person in my life and in the lives of many others who takes very seriously the responsibility of making sure that our generation and generations after that are not messed up by his. So what does that mean? Bittu, hi. It's great to talk to you today.
I'm delighted to be online with you, Renita, and that's a very serious business, you know, this business of my generation, not screwing things up for you guys. It's called intergenerational colonization, and that's a bad thing to do.
Oh my goodness, I can hear that song in my head, My Generation, and now I'm thinking of intergenerational colonization. What does that mean? And most specifically, I'm interested in understanding how that relates to the Wild Woods, which really is the setting of our story. The inspiration for the Wild Woods was actually the forests of ancient India. And I'd love to ask you how this idea of intergenerational colonization impacts the Wild Woods.
It all started with the Wild Woods. I mean, at the end of the day, when the Mughals came across to India, they didn't cut down all the forests. But when the Brits came to India, that was their only purpose, virtually. Half the timber, all the railway lines and everything else, they went deep into the Wild Woods and they made straight lines for the ports. And I'd say that the British Empire was built on the wood that came out of the woods of India. So if you're talking about colonization, that was only geographic colonization. And intergenerational colonization, it means that I'm not just taking your trees for today, but I'm taking your air, I'm taking your water, I'm taking your soil, I'm taking your climate, I'm taking it all, shoving it into a bank, turning it into a short-term profit, and then leaving you out in the ocean without a paddle or a lifeboat. That's what intergenerational colonization is, and it'll be found out, and there will be tribunals of the sort that you saw in Nuremberg, and this is about the ultimate crime on not just humanity, but on life on Earth.
My goodness, this just leads me to think of so many things that our character, our protagonist, Arya, faces in the Wild Woods. I mean, here he is, he finds vanars, he finds animals, he finds forest beings that he had only heard about and thought didn't exist. whether they didn't exist because they went extinct or whether they didn't exist because he thought they were a figment of his imagination, I'd love to ask you about the ecosystems of the wildwoods. What do we find there?
Oh, Lord, how do you begin? The ecosystems of the wildwoods, they are so diverse that it would probably take 10,000 Bibles and 50,000 Gitas to explain what the wildwoods are. Even 1 square meter of those wild woods are impossible to fully understand, even if you took all the brain power of all the Nobel laureates and all those wonderful Aristotles. They couldn't interpret 1 square meter of the wild woods and the interactions that exist between, you know, I mean, the fungi and it's the sun. Just look in that 1 square meter. Every leaf is a solar panel, the ultimate solar panel. Every leaf feeds people and every leaf is fed by people. Every time I breathe out, I feed the leaf with carbon dioxide. Every time it breathes out, it feeds me with oxygen and food. And I could go on forever, but I won't. But let me just put it to you like this. The wild woods are wonderful woods. You go in over there and you're home. You can buy a home in Regent Park. You can buy one on Fifth Avenue. That's not your home. Your home is nature in the wild woods. That's where you live.
So the forests of ancient India, what is it about them that makes them unique? Because like so much of what you've described could be forests anywhere, and they're beautiful forests all over the world. But this specific forest or these specific forests, what is it that makes them, the plants, the animals, the textures, the colors? What is it?
They gave birth to everything. They gave birth to art, to music, to dance, to philosophy, to religions, to everything, because they are so damn diverse. They are so diverse. And these ancient forests that you have in India, it's not just India. Every single forest is actually unique. But in India, if you go down, let's say, to Kanyakumari, or you go down somewhere to Nagarhole, or you go down somewhere to peninsular India, the forests are different. You go westward, you hit the Western Ghats. Those forests are, they're rainforests. You go onto an island and it's impossible. It's not possible for somebody to describe how utterly, absolutely fascinating and utterly diverse those forests are. Let me tell you, if you take a temperate forest, you're talking about 100, 200 species of trees and plants and stuff like this, you know. You go down here, you're talking about 100,000. Now, when you have so much diversity of plant life, you've got so much diversity of animal life, and that's why these wild woods that you're talking about in ancient India, they gave rise to a people who worshipped water. They worshipped the sun. They worshipped the moon. They worshipped the ground. When they had to even take something from the ground, they would apologize and say, "I'm sorry, my mother, for hurting the skin of you, you know, but I need to eat." And it was an apology, and then it was accepted and it was giving. The wild woods of India are, according to me, the soul of this planet. The soul of this planet.
The soul of this planet. Chills. So I'm going to zero in on one aspect of the wild woods that has really sort of played an important role in my life, that of many others, and has stayed with me. And that's the banyan tree, right? I want to just start with a very quick quote given to me by an author in Hong Kong, actually, many years ago. She was an American author. She is an American author. She used to live in Hong Kong as a little girl. And she told me once that when she went back to Hong Kong, it had changed. There were buildings. It was developed. She's like, "But I found my home because I recognized the path of the banyan trees. That's the one thing that doesn't change despite the city." And this is it about the banyan. They are so old. And they are an ecosystem or an ecosystem, however you pronounce it. They are an ecosystem in and of themselves. So tell us a little bit more about this amazing tree.
Oh, Lord, the banyan tree. That's what gave birth to Sanctuary. There's a banyan tree. I believe it's the third largest banyan tree in India. It's at the foot of the ramparts of the Ranthambore Fort, next to a little structure that used to be little called Jogi Mahal. Jogi is a mendicant. You know, he's a person who sits and thinks. And Raja Hamir, it seems, built a shelter around him, because even in the cold. But where was this shelter? It was under a banyan tree. And as far as the banyan tree is concerned, they call it the tree that walks. They call it the tree that never dies. They call it a tree that actually it's like a magnet for life, you know. It's a fig tree. So as far as the banyan tree is concerned, whether you talk of Buddhism, whether you talk of anything, you know, I mean, it's the tree of life. It's the tree of life.
So many questions about this. Firstly, what do you mean the tree that walks? What does that mean?
The tree that walks, because as the banyan tree grows wider and wider, and some of them are, you're talking 100 meters across their branches, their canopy, and things like this, in order to support itself, it sends down roots. So when that root turns into a thin trellis into a root, it begins to support that branch. And then that branch continues, and it goes outward, and it goes outward, and it goes outward. And you, in Calcutta, for instance, in the botanical gardens, that banyan tree, nobody knows where the original root is anymore. And you can go around India. You go to Tamil Nadu, you go to Calcutta, you go to Ranthambore, you go everywhere. The banyan tree is one hell of a tree. It's called the tree that walks, because nobody knows where it started, and nobody actually knows where it's going, except human beings who insist on cutting it down.
Right. I remember as a little girl, when I would look at these trees and the roots hanging down from them, to me, they would look like beards of old wise men. That's the picture that was created in my mind's eye. But more than anything, I was fascinated by the creatures, like so many of them, that found a home in the banyan tree, actually. And in this story, it's the monkeys of the wild woods and the vanars that actually live in the trees, a whole system of banyan trees, which in the story is called the jungle gym, which is the home of the vanars. So tell us about the monkeys, the different kinds of monkeys, and not just them, the different kinds of animals, birds, you know, whatever it is that we see living in these trees.
Well, I'll put it like this, that the tree, the banyan tree, it is so giving that the tree that I talked about, where our magazine Sanctuary was born, there we had a troop of langurs, you know. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, it was a rhesus macaque that led that troop. It was the funniest, most strange thing, natural history observation I'd ever seen. There was this huge, huge rhesus macaque, and he would lead these monkeys wherever they went. He would protect them. He would do X, Y, Z. And if you really, you know, stay long enough in one place, you'll find that these monkeys, they don't sit in the tree and stay there forever. They just move around. A week later, they'll come back to the same forest. They, incidentally, the leaf monkeys that I'm talking about have three stomachs. They eat leaves. They will eat fruit as well. But when they eat that fruit, they are the greatest gardeners of Eden you've ever seen, because when they crap it out, they crap it out with the best fertilizer in the world, and the seeds go. And that's what they are. They are the gardeners of Eden. The banyan tree itself is not just alone. Next to the banyan tree, you might find palm tree. There'll be grasses around it. Under the banyan tree, you find very few other trees. Very few other plants manage to survive, because they're so thick, the canopy is so thick, that the sunlight doesn't touch the floor. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else I can tell you about it, except that it's a ficus. Mm-hmm. It's the symbol of all religions that you can imagine in Asia, not just in India. And I've actually sat under that tree, and 6 feet behind me, behind a campfire, I just heard a guttural sound, you know, arr! And I turned around to look, and I saw nothing in the dark. I shone the light, and I saw a pool of blood A leopard had taken a small somber fawn 8 feet from behind where I sat near a campfire under the banyan tree. There's adventure there every day, every second of every minute.
Fantastic, fantastic. One of the things you said a little bit earlier was that the wild woods was the home to and the source of life, religion, animals,
everything,
right?
Everything.
When I think of the banyan tree, I also think of so many incidences of life that take place under it. You mentioned Gautam Buddha and enlightenment and Buddhism, but something very basic, like even the system of governance, the panchayat, right? In the villages, their meetings are held under the banyan tree. So can you tell us what that is? How does that work? What is the panchayat? What are village politics? And why is the banyan tree so important from that aspect?
The banyan tree is, wherever there is a banyan tree, it becomes the center of life. You get shade in summer. It's warmer under a banyan tree in winter than it is on the outside. And people naturally gravitate towards this tree. The panchayats, you go to any village in India and you will always find that when people sit, they don't have auditoriums to sit and talk. They'll sit under a tree. Mm. Children are taught under a tree. Still, even today, not all kids, but the fact is that the banyan tree I keep on going back to is the one that I know best in Ranthambore. And I'll tell you that, Renita, the banyan tree in Ranthambore, it's not just you, me, who are fascinated. It's actually mentioned, that very same tree is mentioned in the Akbarnama. And if you read the Akbarnama, you'll find that when the invading forces came to pillage the fort and to overrun it, you have a list of what they ate, what they hunted, how it was. That's how old it is, 500, 600, 700. I don't know how old that tree is. And all this while, when people have sat and plotted, how shall we take that fort? They sat under the banyan tree. When people decided that what should we do about this tiger that's visiting us and killing our cows, they sat under the banyan tree. When children swing under the banyan tree and they play under the banyan tree, and I know for a fact that I've had many campfires under the banyan tree over 40 years, and I long to go back. It's home.
There was a wonderful hymn that we came across in, I think it was the Gita, which said, there is a banyan tree which has its roots upward and its branches down. And the Vedic hymns are its leaves. And one who knows this tree is the knower of the Vedas. And specifically, it was referring to this material world as a reflection of the spiritual world, that the material world is but a shadow of reality, and in that shadow, there is no reality or substantiality. But from this shadow, we can understand that there is substance and reality. So I'd love to ask your opinion about that kind of analysis.
Renita, it's like this, that I don't know. I mean, technically, you might even call me an atheist, you know, or a pantheist or something like this. But when I sit under a banyan tree, I just feel one with that tree. I feel a sense of peace. I feel a sense of calm. I imagine that what people call God is actually just that, you know, that I take a breath out and I feed the tree. I take a breath in and the tree feeds me. It makes you contemplate. It also force feeds you with humility. It makes you realize how transient you are and how permanent, semi-permanent, permanent nature is. It just makes you feel, I think it snatches arrogance and avarice away, and it introduces wonder and awe. And I'm now speaking for myself, and I'm speaking for the wild woods, and I'm speaking for all those things. And I find, when I started out by telling you that my purpose in life is to protect your generation from mine, I cannot understand what's happened to all the spirituality that was born in India. I think we've become the gods we've invented. We're not. We're just another little insignificant life form on Earth.
Right. Now, speaking of these life forms, sort of going from the plants to the animals, another aspect of the Wild Woods that I incorporated into the story was the spotted deer. And there are many reasons for this. One is it's a very Indian animal. Of course, there are so many other animals that are also very Indian, so that's not the only reason. But the protagonist, Arya, was based in San Francisco. So spotting deer or seeing deer was, something that happens all the time. A different kind of deer, however. And then there was also this story from the mythology of, how you can be mesmerized by this deer, so mesmerized that you chase it and it leads to something else. So in our story, actually, Arya chases this deer because he's mesmerized by it. It turns out to be a shape-shifting Rakshas later on. But regardless of that, and the music that's created around it is so, I don't know how to describe it. It's just literally you can hear, this deer sort of sprinting through the forest. So tell us about this deer.
It will be called the chital, C-H-I-T-A-L. The scientific name is Axis, the spotted deer. Under that banyan tree, under almost any tree, they're spotted because that's its camouflage. Between dappled sunlight underneath that, if it stands stock still, it could be 20 feet away, just a few branches between you and it, and it won't, you can't see it. So it's, the banyan tree teaches one single simple lesson, eat or be eaten. And the Wild Woods, you have to just respect the Wild Woods and they will look after you. As far as that deer is concerned, Every single waking moment of its life, it's looking out for danger, leopard, python, a tiger, a bear. Sometimes the bear could very well predate on a fawn, wild dogs, all these creatures. And when that tree, that banyan tree is in fruit, when you see those red berries, that is like a magnet. There would be maybe 20, 30 different species of birds in there. It's a great bird watching spot.
So, you're talking about this very classic sort of the fight or flight syndrome, and I can see the deer like sort of looking out for the threats that might surround it. I wanted to ask, going beyond the python and the tiger and the, let's say natural threats, which are part of what you would expect in the forests, in the jungles, are there threats? What are those threats?
The threats are you and me. I mean, we're living in the Anthropocene, and the most dangerous animal in the whole world is Homo sapiens. The primary threat right now is just us. There's no other threat that even comes close to the threat that we pose to all life on Earth, whether it is that the spotted deer. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that deer and the tiger, they represent nothing other than the entire forest. They're metaphors. You can look at them as animals, but the fact is that they're just metaphors. They're metaphors for all of life. And there's peace there. Life starts with that one single tree, and then it spreads outward. And everything, every single creature on Earth, every single, right now where I'm sitting in distant Canada, I can see a butterfly floating around. I saw a cottontail rabbit. I saw a red fox. All these things, they're just symbols of the biosphere that is the magic that produced us. We're just bumped up monkeys ourselves, Rainey. And it's about time we learned that we are subject to the biosphere, and that the easiest way for us to get through the Wild Woods alive is to listen and
obey. So when you say the threats are you and me, are you referring to us destroying these forests to so-called develop and so-called evolve, perhaps what we're calling evolution, whatever that means. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, we consume too much. We want too much. We are so insecure. We think that buying things and owning things is what it's all about. But imagine for a moment that you buy a bottle of water. Nobody would have thought of that 50 years ago, you know. But you buy a bottle of water for, let's say, a dollar. If you suddenly found there was no water to drink, you'd be paying $100,000 for that one bottle of water because you can't live without it beyond a point. So when I say that we're the greatest threat, I mean, it's like we are destroying the cradle of our own existence. We're destroying our womb. And that's what the wild woods are. It's our womb. That's where we came. Of course, we all came from the sea. For me, when you're talking of the wild woods of India, I'm also thinking of Kanyakumari. I'm also thinking of the Bay of Bengal and the Sundarbans.
Right.
It's all the same for me, you know. It's all the same. It's just the same as saying that your toe and your hair and your fingernails and your shoulder muscles, and it's all one entity. The whole thing is one entity. Gaia. That's what they used to call it.
Right. Gaia. Now, it's interesting because as you talk about the different aspects or areas of the wild woods, you talk about the Sundarbans or Kanyakumari. One of the sort of subsystems featured in the story is very much that of the backwaters towards Kanyakumari further south, right? And the coconut groves surrounding those backwaters. The backwaters have a unique ecosystem, fresh water from the rivers, meeting the seawater from the sea, the Arabian Sea. Tell us more about that. What makes that area? Why is it the backwaters? And will it stay that way?
Will it stay that way? $1 million question. First of all, the backwaters, you got it right. At high tide, you get, you know, water that comes in. Sometimes it's, you get rivers that flow into the sea and you get tides that flow towards the land. And at that meeting point, you have diversity beyond comprehension. When I spoke to you about the Sundarbans, at some point or the other, since all life began in the sea, it has to have begun at the margins like this when sea creatures moved to, we were just algal forms, you know. And even today, at these margins, whether they're seagrasses, whether they're kelp forests, whether they're mangroves, these backwaters that you just referred to in Kerala and places like this, these are teeming with life. These are what gave birth to all our civilizations. Without these, we would have had no food, we would have had no shelter, we would have had no fresh water, we would have been naked and dead, you know. Mouse that roared.
So what kinds of life, what kinds of species do we see here? Crabs, frogs, aquatic life, I assume. Anything else?
Dolphins. Birds,
dolphins.
You'll see dolphins. You'll see in many of these places, like, I mean, not necessarily in the backwaters of Kerala, but in many of these coastal areas where seawater and freshwater meet, you'll find sharks coming up. You'll find many of the creatures of the sea actually come to these margins to breed. The egg cases of sharks, for instance, are attached to mangroves. And there, when they emerge, they stay around over there until they're big enough. Some of these margins are actually what gave birth to the diversity of life we see around us.
But specifically...
No,
I was going to ask, in areas like Kochi and Kollam and Alappi, and where you see the river systems, what do we find? Do we find birds? Do we find turtles? Do we find an interplay between birds and turtles?
You find everything from tigers and elephants and all the creatures that associated with them. Of course, you find birds. These are staging points for birds that come from across the Himalaya. There, in fact, parts of this, in the Western Ghats, you'll find dragonflies, for instance. Dragonflies, they give birth underwater, then they come out on wing. And these dragonflies, Renita, they can actually fly across from India, and they do fly to Africa, across the oceans. There's magic in the world. We don't even begin to understand what magic exists. It's like a huge library that hasn't been cataloged, and we're burning the library down. Mm. I'm sorry, I keep coming back to the fact that my generation is burning the libraries down. And there's a cornucopia here. Food, mm-hmm. medicine, life, happiness, joy, continuity,
right.
Everything.
So I wanted to ask about the coconut trees, because these are the state tree of Kerala. And Kerala, as I understand, is a combination of two words meaning coconut and alam meaning land. Kera meaning coconut and alam meaning land. So are the coconut trees native to this area? Were they brought in at some point? And when you talk about sort of this cornucopia of food, medicine, the coconut really is one example of, you know, a plant or a fruit or a tree, and every aspect of it is useful. Is that right?
It's completely right. But remember, the coconut is a wanderer. When a coconut falls into the sea, the currents can sometimes take it far away, 500 kilometers away, onto an island, and there it turns into another tree. So like the banyan tree, in a sense, wind and water, they take the coconut shell away. Now, is it a tree that was introduced to Kerala? We don't know way back. I wouldn't be able to answer that. But I do know this, that it is a tree that gives everything. Every fiber is used. And in fact, I think that we might be overdoing it. We've got too many coconut trees. And some of these coconut trees are planted because you can earn a living from them. But we're taking away parts of the rainforest sometimes, you know, and too much of anything is bad, Rini. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying coconut trees are bad. I'm saying coconut trees are trees of life. But everything right. in its place. I mean, everything in its place.
I love how you describe how they can be carried away 500 kilometers. It's like a different kind of pollination. Or it is pollination, but... Yep. You know, we think about pollination in other terms.
Yeah. The coconut tree is not, I mean, the flower will be pollinated, you know, but the fact is that the seed is carried. Mm-hmm. The seed can be carried very far. In fact, this wild wood that you're talking of coconuts, and let me remind you about mangoes. Mangoes are, you know, transported. There are two creatures above all else, three, that transport mango seeds. And that's why we've got such fantastic diversity of mangoes. You have monkeys, they eat the fruit, they eat the pulp, and they cast away the seed, and another seed grows. Then you got elephants. Now the elephants will move 200, 300 kilometers. That's their migratory routes. They'll eat it here, they'll shit it out over there, and then you get a new tree. Same thing with bears. And bats, nobody thinks in terms of bats, but bats, they have a feeding range of 400 kilometers sometimes, square kilometers, you know, a circumference. And so the bats will take their food from a favorite tree and come back to the roost. Sometimes they'll feed the young ones who are hanging on to them. It's nature is actually just one big conspiracy for life. By the way, do you know that human beings are the only animals in the entire biosphere that have the technology to waste and create waste? There's not a single other creature, not a cockroach, not a scorpion, not a snake, not nothing. There's nothing that has the technology to waste. Everything that is becomes something else, and it adds to life.
That's crazy. Nobody else has the technology to waste. We have the technology to waste. We create the technology to waste. And now we're trying to create technology to not waste.
Well, it's the American Army thing, hurry up and wait. You know, I mean, all we're doing is going around in circles, quite frankly, treading on our own tails. If we just sat back and left things alone.
Right. And I just wonder if... Do we make too much effort, or should less effort be made? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is.
I think that we make too much effort, but the effort that we are making is not for the right things. I mean, we're pillaging the Garden of Eden, and instead of just sitting back and waiting for the fruit to fall, we're so insecure that we want 60 different mangoes and we want to put them in freezers and we want to have the mangoes off season and we can go on, but I don't want to lecture anybody. I want children particularly. My constituency is really 12 years on an average, that 12 years old. And I say to them, the magic of reality is where it's all at. And I ask the children who we've taken into these wild woods you're talking about, wouldn't you like to live in a magic house? The windows right. are lollipop, the doors are chocolate. You open the tap and you get lemonade. And they say, yes, Uncle Bittu, this is exactly what we would love to have. And I said, suppose somebody destroyed it. No, that's horrible. How can they destroy it? I said, but every langur, every one of these langurs, every bird lives in a magic house. It lives in the house. It eats the house. And when it goes to sleep, boom, everything right. comes back to where it was. That's homeostasis.
Yeah.
A long word for a very simple thing. Everything finds its balance and everything fixes itself.
Speaking of that, I mean, the one thing I must ask you about before we close the conversation is the idea of the Vanars. Now, the Vanars are mentioned time and again in the mythology and as something between a man and a monkey. One interpretation is that these are, in fact, monkeys. You've talked about the langurs and the rhesus macaques and, you know, all the other varieties. Another interpretation is that they are something between a man and a monkey, but perhaps this species has gone extinct. So I'd love to ask you, what are the Vanars? Are they based on a real species?
See, Vanar, the word merely means monkey at the end of the day. And everybody's been looking for that missing link, you know. Mm-hmm. But the hard scientific fact is that between chimps and bonobos, we came from there. Now, where and how the stories were told, you must remember that today we've got DNA analysis, we've got all kinds of things, and science is bringing us closer to our origins, our real origins. But in the days of yore, we were so... When the Gita was written and the Mahabharata was written and the Ramayana was written, we were so in awe of nature that when we looked up at the sun, we knew it was the source of life. There isn't a single stream you can go to which is wider than 20 feet where there isn't a temple of sorts, because water was the source of life. And these Vanars that you're talking about, I think that they were at some point a jump. Human beings, in our minds, we had to make a jump. We see the monkeys, we see the similarities, two eyes, teeth, five fingers, you know, we see the similarities and we say somewhere that changed into us. Today, if you ask the scientists, they'll tell you, well, just look at the DNA of the chimp or the bonobo, 99% same as ours, you know, and we learn to walk and... Really, it goes into so much scientific, explanation. But I just love the fact that we are... There are funny stories about this as well. I don't know if they fit into this story or not. But the fact is, we're just bumped up monkeys. And I'm very proud to be a primate. And I think that it's about time that we learned that as primates, we live in a village. We live together. We live by cooperation. And we don't go to schools. I'm talking now as one of the primates that lives on a tree. Our only learning came from play. We have aunts that look after us when the mother has to feed. We support each other, but we've set ourselves against each other now. And that somehow seems to be the lesson that the wild woods are trying to teach human beings. Don't fight between yourselves and don't act like neighbors from hell. Be grateful for what you have. And actually, in my case, I'm looking for a hammock and two trees so I can just sit back and wait for food right. to drop into my mouth, which will happen if I don't destroy the sacred forest.
So when we talk about climate change and the fight against climate change and climate warriors and cli-fi, which is a new area of fiction, you know, climate science fiction or yeah. climate fiction. How does this tie into the forests? deforestation or change in the forests? Is the study or what's happening with the forests an aspect of climate change, or is it totally separate?
It's the same thing. The forest is the climate. The forest is the climate, as is the soil. It's all one super organism. So when you're talking about climate change, for instance, you cannot, and I'm making an absolute statement here, you can take all the scientists of the world and put them all together and put them in one huge factory, and they won't be able to control the climate. They won't be able to bring the carbon down. They'll be able to do damn all. But the simplest way to bring the carbon down is to allow a seed to grow into a tree. And when you do that, 50% of the dry weight of a tree that is 10 tons is pure atmospheric carbon. And it started out as a seed that was no more than 1 gram. So climate and biodiversity, these two things are two sides of one coin. Without biodiversity, forget about trying to tame the climate. In fact, the pandemic you see around you today, if you read something called the Dasgupta Review, or you read the Intergovernmental Science Panel on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, IPBES, it's clear as day. The biodiversity of this planet is what gave us our atmosphere. It's what gave us our diversity. It's the immune system of the planet, as Swati Thyagarajan keeps saying. And if we don't understand that right now, then I would say that we might be one of the shortest lived species that ever walked planet Earth.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing all of this wisdom with us today. I cannot wait to sort of further this conversation. As you know, I will when I catch you by myself, by yourself, I'll be like pounding you with more questions. But in the meantime, for our listeners, please tell us where we can find out more about you, the work you're doing, and just the work we should be doing.
As far as Sanctuary is concerned, we're the Sanctuary Nature Foundation. And if you key that into Mr. Google, he'll give you all the answers. But I would say that every time you look at a tree, think of us. Because not just us, like Queen Victoria, I'm speaking of the royal plural. All of us, you, me, the camel. We're just pixels on a very beautiful, large canvas.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us today. That was just so enlightening. I cannot even begin to tell you.
I hope so, Rini. I hope so, because at the end of the day, remember, I'm 75 and I don't know what the means of communication are now, but I want young people to be able to communicate with each other. And if this episode could be ended by just one thing, saying the forest teaches us, but really what we need now is an adult literacy program, where each child teaches an adult what it means to be good neighbors rather than neighbors from hell. So I really look forward to the young people taking charge. If I had a fast forward button, I'd make you the prime minister. I'd make some 11-year-old into the environment minister, and certainly make sure that the agriculture ministers and the food ministries of the world understand that it's nature that feeds you, not some damn corporation.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. I mean, so many things. The fact that it is the children of tomorrow who need to teach the adults of day after, because that's the only way we're going to be able to make this work. And make sure that the final salvation is not final, actually, that it leads to a bigger and better and more beautiful life, one more in sync with the way things were before. So thank you for that.
A safer and a happier life. Actually, if I have a blessing, it is just this. I have no wish for any child other than that that child be safe and happy.
That's just fantastic. I think you've given us the nuggets for pre-production season 7. Thank you.
Take care.
That was our guest, Bittu Sehgal. He is the editor of Sanctuary Magazine, a 40-year-old magazine about the environment in India. He is also the founder of the Sanctuary Nature Foundation. And I am Renita Hora, creator of Shadow Realm and the Aria Chronicles series.